worms crawl in, the worms crawl out. They'll eat your guts and spit them out. And when your bones begin to rot, the worms remain, but you do not. So don't ever laugh as a hearse goes by, for someday you'll be next in line. And when death brings his cold despair, ask yourself, will anyone care?
Macabre may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
We're on a roll of talking about some pretty, I don't even know the word. Despicable people, I guess you could say. Today's gonna be another discussion, for sure. There's a lot behind the scenes. There's like six theories out there about why and what went down because of what, and it's just really wild. Well, we're gonna start this thing off right, because woof, we're in for it today. So welcome, hello, you are listening to Macabre, a Dark History Podcast. I'm Blair.
I'm Holly.
And thank you very much for choosing us as your entertainment of the hour. We have a pretty jam-packed episode for you today. This episode is brought to you by a listener. We really haven't had an alphabet episode yet coming from a listener, but because of the subject at hand, this was too big for a hometown macabre. So I'm going to let this person introduce this to you by their account. It's a big subject. I am not naming names today. They choose to be anonymous, and we will respect their wishes for such. So our listener says, "Hey ladies, after hearing some other people write into the show, I decided to try it out. Please do not use my name, as the people involved are family, and it's a highly sensitive topic. I have also chosen to leave years and school names out of this as well." Okay, here we go. Back when my cousins were in high school, they did what a lot of teenagers do, and they partied. Well, one night at a party that started like any other, it ended with shock. They found out that their really good friend, Mike, wasn't who they thought he was. After some amount of drinks, he started talking about his life. And come to find out, Mike, well, his name wasn't actually Mike. It was Valentine. His parents weren't in the picture because, well, his parents, half of them, were in jail. His one parent being Mary Brunner. If you don't know that name, you might know his father's name, Charles Manson.
Holy fuck.
Uh-huh. I was like, are you kidding me right now? They go on to say, well, hope I made you spoop. love you, ladies. Keep up the great work. You really have something going here. Love your show. Thank you for doing what you do. Love, Anonymous. Well,
I have questions.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So, okay. So this kid at a party.
Yeah.
Go as high school students. Yes. Okay. So hold on. What you're saying is this person that wrote in is the child of Manson?
So the subject is him, but no, this listener. So, and I didn't include the whole message.
Is a friend of.
They're actually cousins with this Mike. So the listener is the cousins of the friends who are friends with Mike in high school.
Okay, yes. Okay. Who is the son of.
Correct. Yep.
Who just has been under the radar.
Yes.
Keeping anonymous as children of.
Right. Yeah.
People often do. Yeah.
And I
go by names, right. Different names and stuff. Holy yes. shit.
And I clipped some other stuff out because it would have definitely given some things away. And if this person didn't want even some of their family knowing, I didn't want to even add some of that. But no. So this person that wrote to us, their cousins were very good friends with Mike. And they were the ones at that party. And they had been friends, it sounded like, with Mike for quite some time. And they had partied with him before. But this particular night, he might have just not had a good intoxicated experience. We've all been.
You would wonder how much he looked like him, though, because, you know, Manson has a look. Mm-hmm. You'd be like, oh, dude, you kind of look like, has everyone ever told you you look like right? Manson?
Right.
You kind of have that look.
Yeah.
I wonder if he's small.
I don't know. Mm.
That is wild.
Very wild. And Anonymous, if you're listening, maybe I did spoop. You don't know. it's fucking wild because I brought this to you before. And I think maybe we mentioned it in a Patreon episode on the back end. Long story short, this is just kind of weird. But my aunt worked with Mary Brenner's mom, which is fucking wild. Small world. So it's just very weird. She worked with her at the time that all of this shit went down too.
Oh, that'd be crazy.
Yeah. And I'm not gonna name names. I'm not gonna say where my aunt worked or anything like that, but definitely local, I will say. So I won't say any more than that to keep people's identities private. And we'll get into why. And I won't be revealing anything to kind of give Mike's stuff away. You know, he's trying to live a low profile life. And we should definitely respect that. But yeah, you can't tell me we got a message like that about a listener tale and I'm not going to fucking cover Manson after hearing that shit.
Yeah.
Holy ball sacks. Okay. Yeah. So in case you didn't know what we were covering today, you could say M is for Manson for sure. Also, Anonymous, I just want to say thank you very much for submitting your story to us. It means a great deal. And this is a big one. This is a huge one. And a story like that, we just can't not cover it. So before we dive into it, I did it again. What is with this accent
just
shit?
Just dive into it.
Yeah, something's up.
I love you.
I love you too. I don't want to doubt fire this episode. So we're getting there. I did that last episode too. So the hype notes. Hype notes I put, California in the 1960s was a wild time. Hollywood, the music scene, and cults? Well, this week, it's all about the Manson family and the cult leader himself. So hold on to your ears because we're going to get helter skelter up in this culty edition of Macabre. Officially our first episode about a cult. Okay. Are you ready for this?
I am so ready.
Oh, we're diving deep. I chose, so note that this show is not for the faint of heart. We are going to be covering some pretty brutal things and it's pretty grotesque. So this is your trigger warning. It's violent and it's very murdery. So if you need to skip ahead or, you know, kind of give it a pass, please do that. As always, you're looking for something more lighthearted. May I interest you in the Eyes for Idioms Part 1 and 2? But it's going to get weird. I'm not covering every single member of the Manson family today because there is well over 60 people that were involved.
Shit. Uh-huh.
But we're going to cover some big name members, where they came from. We're going to cover Manson, where he came from, to see how this all fucking started. And then we're going to talk about some shit. So let's start with Charles. On November 12th of 1934 in Cincinnati, Ohio, Charles Miles Maddox was born. He went without a name for weeks before his mother decided to name him Charles.
Not a great start.
Nope. And we have to talk about her too, because she's kind of the reason this really took off on the wrong foot. His mother was 16 years old. Her name was Kathleen Maddox, and she was already an alcoholic and a sex worker who did some things on the side to earn money in devious ways. And we'll get into that too. His father, Colonel Walker Henderson Scott Sr., who would leave Kathleen after she told her that she was pregnant, he would never be in the picture. Whether that was something that she was doing for her job, or if they were kind of seeing each other on the side, she was definitely involved with him for a good while before this happened. He did not want to deal with a pregnancy. That's kind of a big common theme of the time. So it's just one of those stories where he's not involved in the picture. I can't imagine what he thought about after the fact, when all of this stuff went down, if he kind of put two together.
Yeah. If he was alive during that time too, like he, I don't know the situation, but right. Yeah.
Yeah. So Kathleen's criminal record, it had some doozies on there, and she definitely built that on her own. It rubbed off on Charles immensely. He was very influenced by his mom growing up. And it's sad because he didn't really have a chance. And he wanted to be with his mom, and she really, like, stiff-armed him. At a very young age, he lived with his aunt and uncle in West Virginia because Kathleen was put in prison for armed robbery during that time. They were pretty religious, and they had raised him right. They really tried hard for him. And he did well for quite a while, but he had already seen what it was like on the side with his mom doing things. He wasn't like harming animals or anything like that, but he just had an inkling for crime from a very young age. And we'll get into how young. But while he was living with his aunt and uncle, he fell in love with music, really became attached to it. They had a piano in their house. And so he learned how to play the piano. They would take him to church, and he was known to sing very boisterously during like the sermons and the hymns. He was very into it, but that was the only reason why he liked going to church. Otherwise, it was reported that he couldn't care less. It was really for the music. So once things started to progress with him, he got a little bit older. His love for music would continue to grow, but so would his demeanor when it came to outside of the house dealing with crime. Charles would be in trouble with the law by the age of 9.
Oh, damn.
He spent most of his life in prison, and we'll get to why. So later he would be reunited with his mom when she got out, and she started dating a William Manson. He would again go to live with her. It wasn't great though. He would be given the last name of Manson, and Kathleen wouldn't stay married to William very long. They didn't have a very good marriage. There are a lot of reports that say that William was a very well-known heavy drinker in the community, and it would be not uncommon for him to, like, disappear for days on end without any sort of contact of, like, hey, where did you go? And he'd just show up back to the house like nothing happened. So you can kind of see where this is going with Charles. There's a lot of abandonment, neglect going on besides his aunt and uncle's house. But clearly it made a lot of an impact, a very big impact on his life, and it's only going to build from here. So, of course, you can imagine that this marriage with Kathleen and William didn't last very long. And Charles was shipped off to an all-boys school at the age of 12 because his mom didn't want him to live with her anymore. She was definitely going back to her old ways, and she didn't want him involved, and she didn't want him to take care of him. She didn't want to take responsibility. And this really tore him up because he just, I mean, he's a young kid. Like, he just wants to be with a parent.
Mm-hmm.
He tried to go home many times, and his mom would every single time reject him. And so he rebelled, and he did what he knew, which was commit crimes. So he continued to do it, because we'll soon figure out that he felt more comfortable being in jail than he did society.
Yeah. Makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
In his teen years, he started spending time in prison and was considered at that age to be a dangerous prisoner. Whether he really, just to the core, is that bad of a person, which, I mean, I guess you can argue that, but also, how much was it that he just tried to stay in jail? And so he did whatever he thought he could to make sure he stayed there. I mean, it wouldn't be the first person. He was behind bars for a while. He went to a reform school, and this is just a pattern that you would see for the rest of his childhood. He was in and out of jail, and then he would go to a reform school. And then he would get transferred because he would do something even more crazy than the time before, and he'd have to be transferred somewhere else because they couldn't handle him. And we'll talk a little bit about some of those details, but for time's sake, I left a lot of it out. But this, knowing that, just hearing what I'm going to tell you, you're like, holy shit. He was described as being unpredictable. And in his probation records, it stated, suffering from a marked degree of rejection, instability, and psychic trauma. And, quote, constantly striving for status and securing some kind of love, end quote. He had committed many offenses, and they varied. But some of the more notable ones were passing stolen checks and pimping. Uh-huh.
Pimping. The pimp life. It's very 60s and 70s, yes, of him.
Exactly. But then knowing that at the age he was at, I'm just like,
what? How?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. I don't know.
And like just thinking of him as a person and like his stature and his look and like, I could see Prince doing that. Like, he gives off that, you know, he's got that. He could do anything, but like Manson, I don't know.
Because, I mean, we didn't talk about that yet, but Manson was not a tall guy.
No, he was not. Like, he was little dude. Like 5 foot tall, right? Like barely 5 foot tall. Yeah. He had some charisma, though. There's no doubt about that. Like,
definitely.
Yeah.
Where he lacked in height, he gained.
He made up in.
Yeah. And that plays a huge role in how he got people to be in this cult, in this family, because he knew how to play people. Oh, wait, we'll get there. We will get there. This is just, Oh, I've got some things.
And also, like, side note, like, think what good he could have done if he would have gone another direction.
Exactly.
But we could save that discussion for the end. Right. Sorry, tangent.
No, exactly. Like, it's why is it that some of the most brilliant
like Hitler. You know, like,
imagine what he could have done if it would have been flipped for the good. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, what if you weren't a raging evil asshole?
Who was high on methamphetamines all the time.
Like, yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
In an alternate universe.
Yeah, I'd like to know how it turned out, because here, no. But yeah, so now that you know what kind of crimes he's committing, and it ranged, but those were the big ones. His favorites? Question mark? I don't know. He kept getting transferred, like I was saying, so many times to so many different security facilities and reformatory schools all over the U.S. Like, it was like a juvenile tour. I guess you could put it like he was like hopping states and
now touring.
Yeah, now touring. In a state near you. Yeah. It was just wild. And I make that kind of joke because music is going to play a huge, huge role in this. But yeah, it. Whoa. Just the buildup of him and the backstory before he even got to California is just, oh my. So while he was at the National Training School for Boys, he was heavily psychologically evaluated, where he was reported for being aggressively antisocial, which played a big role later. He doesn't really know how to be around people, and he doesn't necessarily like to be around people. How this all came to be is like, okay. So they actually recommended him, because of his evaluation, they recommended him to be transferred again. And this time he was moved to the Natural Bridge Honor Camp. So he had a parole hearing scheduled for 1952. But before the hearing could ever even take place, when he found out about it, Manson decided that he was going to do something that is like beyond words. And it's because he didn't want to leave. I think he did this strictly to stay behind bars. Very graphic trigger warning here for sexual assault, okay?
Uh-huh.
Now, he's young. He's in a place with other young boys, okay? He was caught raping a boy at knife point.
Oh, no.
Yes.
I did not know this.
Oh, I didn't know this either until I started digging. I was like, oh my gosh. And this wasn't the only incident of this, but he did it because he wanted to stay where he was. Like, he didn't want to get out. It was very clear. And the lengths that he goes to be at a certain place, not okay. This is the beginning of what's to come. Because of what he did, he had to be transferred again. So that this time they had to send him to a federal reformatory school in Petersburg, Virginia, where he had committed more sexual crimes against other boys.
What the fuck? I never knew this about him.
Yeah. He did a lot of shit. And when you hear about his testimonies later about how he claimed to be innocent on everything because he technically didn't do anything. Nah.
Oh, right. Everybody else was responsible, like, for the murders and stuff. Like, he didn't do anything wrong.
Right. We'll get into that for sure. But yeah, there is no sort of, I don't even know what the term is, but a good bone, I guess, in the body. Kind of like he was out to do what would benefit him basically his whole life, and he didn't care how he got there. After he did that, you can guess he was transferred again, and this time he would be back in Ohio in a maximum security facility. And did I tell you that this was all before he turned to be an adult, right? So now we're going to start seeing how he's going to evolve once he is an adult. He didn't get released until he was 20 years old. And that was in 1954. And he went back to live with his aunt and uncle because, of course, his mom is not in the picture. A year later, he would marry a very young waitress by the name of Rosalie Jean Willis. And for a little while, at least, he settled down and was very content with living a happy life. But Rosalie never really knew about what he was doing on the side, because he did try to have a respectable job, small career, but he was stealing cars on the outside of it. And it just is just weird. They were fine. They were happy. She got pregnant. And he decided that he needed to take another measure. I don't know if he was ready to have a family, but he decided, you know what? I want to move to Los Angeles. So he convinced her to actually go through with it. And one day he showed up with a car and said, get in, we're going. Well, this car was definitely stolen. And they headed out west and they were caught. Rosalie, not being any the wiser of what was actually going down, was like, what is even happening here? Well, he got sentenced for 3 years for this crime in Pedro, California. And while he was in there, respectfully so, Rosalie wanted to get out of the marriage. She did not want to be involved with that. She wasn't really aware of what he had done in the past.
That was my question, is like, how did she not know all of the shit that happened? But the time, for the times, it's not like she could Google him and do all the research to look up his past record. So he probably just fucking lied to her, like most criminals do.
Right. And so. She was so young. And especially when you look at who was in the Manson family, he had a way of talking with younger girls and kind of getting them to really be attached to him. And I think that kind of came from the whole pimping thing, because he had people that he pimped out that they really truly thought that they were exclusively in a relationship, and he pulled one of those. Not a good situation. So, I mean, Rosalie, she fought for that divorce. She did end up getting one. She ended up meeting another man and they wanted to get married. But when Manson found out about all of this, he tried escaping jail to go find her. And he was caught, luckily. So he didn't get probation when he was supposed to because of that. But when he finally got out, guess what he did? He
pimped. Some heinous shit?
Yeah. He pimped. He forged checks. In only ways that he did.
And classic Charlie.
Classic Charlie. And he got arrested again. Who's surprised?
Yeah. Go figure.
Yeah. And he was sent this time to McNeil Island Prison, which is located in the state of Washington. And this happened in 1961. And I could go into details about how this all happened, but honestly, we don't have time for it, for all the stuff we want to get to. But just know, wild. He would spend 10 years there in McNeil Island Prison. Yeah. And while he was there, he learned how to read music and play guitar from another inmate that he became close with. This would set him up later. He was always obsessed with music, and it really became a huge part of his life during this time. He had a thing for music that just took him to another level in his life, and it ended up ending with some pretty deadly situations. But when he was released, he moved to San Francisco. And let's look at the time frame. This is a big time, specifically in California. There's a lot of political stuff going on. This is like the age of the hippie, you know? This was like bohemian culture all over it. So knowing that he was in prison most of his life, coming out and seeing how different the world was, he was very intrigued. And this is when he started to realize that there's a lot of young and impressionable people that moved to California to be part of this free movement. And he knew exactly how to take advantage of people like that. So he gained a big following in this bohemian young culture of the area. Carefree. It's about love, not war. And he saw an opportunity. So by 1968, he became the leader of what they called the family. And wow, I'm exhausted after just reading about his early life.
Yeah.
We have to talk about the Manson family cult. And we're going to talk about specific individuals, where they came from, what their backgrounds were like. Because it all is interweaved into what happened. So what was this cult based off of? Because every cult starts with one thing, one message, one desire, right? So what was Manson doing here? This was technically a communal religious cult that Charles had created based off of science fiction, fringe psychology, and other occult teachings that he knew of. He combined all of these together to create one weird religious cult of his own. He had his own random unique teachings. When you combine his charisma and this type of message and young people who were definitely doing drugs, experimenting with new ones at the time, it got interesting. So his main preaching point was that there was a war coming, apocalyptic level, really. And this was going to be a race war. And it would be nothing like the world has ever seen. And it would annihilate the entire United States of America. And their family would be the only to survive. And they would then take over. And that's putting that message politely, because after listening to a lot of interviews with Charles Manson, I'm not going to repeat any of his quotes because they're not great. And we're going to talk about why he talked about a race war, because, well, let's look at it. April of 1968, what happened? Martin Luther King was assassinated. Big uproar around the country. This was a time where race was a huge topic, a tense topic, and people were being murdered over it. People were being jailed, beaten, not a great time. And with the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., it only got worse. And California was a big spot for a lot of influential things to happen. So we're definitely going to talk about this a little bit more. Charles was coming out of this in a different way because he was so far removed from society that he was seeing things differently than other people were, and he knew how to take advantage of it. I'm going to keep saying that because it's going to get worse. And a lot of people were really afraid of what our future looked like as a country because of things that were going down during this time. So, better understanding of why this whole thing about a race war was so prominent for some of these people that joined was California at the time, not a good place when it came to race. So we had the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968. And a few years before in Los Angeles, you had what was called the Watts Riots of 65. Have you heard of that?
I have not.
It happened more than one time. Actually, there was another incident in the 90s. It would definitely be a topic to cover for a Hometown Macabre for sure. It was a lot of upheaval. So during this specific one in 65, a lot of upheaval took place in the south central neighborhoods of the area, and most of which were African American neighborhoods, and the violence ensued for 6 days straight, which began after a man named Marquette Fry was arrested for allegedly being intoxicated while driving by a white cop. So it was white cop, black victim here, which unfortunately we are very familiar with this type of scenario.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even today. At the time, it was even worse. Well, I mean, look what we were just discussing. It was a lot worse, a lot more tense, a lot more shit went down. And with the Watts riots, it couldn't be heavier. I mean, it was just awful. A lot of people got hurt. A lot of people that were very, very, very innocent. And the media, they didn't do the best at covering it, but
that's not new either.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's a big topic. So unfortunately, we can't really do it justice in this episode, but just to kind of give you a background on it, we can't properly cover it here, but just know that that was a big, reason on why this was a huge message for him in the cult. It scared a lot of people because there were fires, there were buildings broken into, vandalism, structures coming down, people being beaten. It's not a good part of our history, for sure. So because of that, California was shaking at the time for different reasons, and it was a epicenter for a lot of historical craziness, really, that was going on at the time. 60s, I don't care what anybody says about people in our day and age, or, oh, you kids are so crazy and you're getting into the wildest stuff. I'm sorry, do you want to talk about the 60s? Not a great time. So back on the subject, Manson, freshly out of jail, taking advantage of a lot of these young people, he made an impact on the young culture, for sure. And he grew a following quite quickly. So before this was the prominent teaching of the cult, he was actually getting people by saying that he had prophecies and that he was claiming to be Jesus. And this is how it all started. Yeah.
That's a big, big statement to make.
A big statement.
So he basically said he was Jesus?
Yeah. That's how he first drew people in. Because he actually had a few followers that were very religious that were looking for something. And we'll kind of talk about their backgrounds a little bit too. But people actually thought that he was the coming of Jesus for a little while. And when things started getting, I don't know, more crazy, and he was just trying to keep people at that point and kind of go to the next level, if you want to call it that, for his own gains, that's when the whole race war talk started coming into it. It was a thing. He said he was Jesus. He said he had visions and prophecies. Dudes, no. So, and I know I talked about this before, but I watched a few interviews with him. Whoa. If you were to look up the word unstable in the dictionary, it might be just his face.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the sad thing is the people that he was drawing in were obviously, they had some issues too. Yes. And, they would also fall under the unstable category. But mm-hmm. It's you didn't see any red flags at any point.
Right. And especially with even hearing some of his, and we'll kind of talk about this too, but there's recordings of him talking back in the day, prime time, family time. And it's why would you not get a vibe off of him that was less than ideal, Nope. Just hearing him talk is kind of unsettling. But sometimes when it comes to cults, seeing it from the outside is easier than people get drawn in. So the thing is his cult, it was less than 100 followers. We're talking 60-ish. At least that's how many were caught. Whether or not there are other people that remain unnamed that were in for a fleeting moment and then left, that's a whole other story. In some cases, I have heard that it was about 100 in all from beginning to end. But for this case, we're going to say definitely under 100 because they confirmed and caught 60-ish. In that group, there was an even smaller, more hardcore follower group, most of them being young women who were very much attached to Charlie in a lot of ways. And he knew how to see where people were hurting and making that his magnet in a way. He could tell when people had been abandoned or they had a rough childhood, and he honed in on that hard. He played that game. Yeah.
He would definitely have an understanding of that, purely from that psychological standpoint, but also just understanding people's histories. So.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
And when you hear about some of the people's backgrounds, it's like, oh man, you could have.
So sad.
Yeah, exactly. Another thing that really influenced the group that should be known before we start really getting into it is there was a lot of LSD and shrooms involved, and that would be a way that he would influence them. There wasn't a lot of food. We'll get into what they did for food. Not a lot of sleep. It's that classic depravity to gain power over somebody aspect of a cult, right? So where did this start? Where did they go? So it's this whole concept of the family started in San Francisco, not San Francisco. Whoa, get it together. But they...
it might be San Francisco, yeah. If you want to talk about the context of things.
Right. Yeah, it could. It really could. 60s man, I tell you. But they started in San Fran, which... you know, epicenter for the movement, but they ended up moving to an abandoned ranch in San Fernando Valley. So we need to talk about the members now. Now that we kind of know where the cult was, what they were about, let's talk about some of these members. And we'll go into why we're talking about these specific people and what they meant in the Manson family cult. And I won't go through every member, of course. We don't have the time for that. There were many of them, but we're going to go through the impactful handful, I'll say. So we're going to start with Robert Beausoleil. And I'm also going to give you the nicknames of these people for the lighthearted aspect of the episode.
Oh, I like that.
Oh, yeah. They're pretty great. And no, I will not give you context of these because I don't know if there even is.
Can we pick our own nicknames later?
If you want, yeah.
For each other?
Yeah, I like that. Let's do it. Okay. Let's do it. Okay. Because when you hear these, it's just...
Okay.
So, he often was called Bobby, which makes sense. You know, his name is Robert, but... he was also Gary Boy, Box Boy, Cherub, and Cupid.
Okay.
And... I won't give background on the Cupid. At least he was notably one of the most attractive of...
I could.
So he had a favor with the ladies, let's just say. And he was an influence for his looks and actually his musical talent too. But we'll talk about that. He came from a working class family out of Santa Barbara, California. So not, you know, same state. Because some of them did not come from the same state. We'll get there. He was a rebel from the very beginning. And he ended up in a reform school too, just like Charlie. And this would happen by the age of 15 for him. So he was a little bit older once he had to see the inside of a reformatory. But he was still there and he understood Charlie. When he got out, he got involved with acting and music and became very infatuated with both. He joined a few bands, most notably the band Love. He was with them for a while. Love's got some good stuff. In 1967, he met Kenneth Anger, and actually, he had a part in the film Lucifer Rising. Did you know that?
I did not.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. I was like, so now I kind of want to go back and watch it to be like, where is Gary Boy, you know?
Yeah, is he still in it or did they like re-edit and remove him?
Good question.
You know how sometimes they do? That's my question.
I don't know. I'd have to look into that. I feel like they might have left him in, but who knows? I'll have to look into that. The last thing that I have to say about Robert is he was living with Gary Hinman in 1969 when he started associating with Manson. Hinman will come back later, but I wanted to say that about him and how that ties into what happens. So we're going to talk now about Susan Atkins. Some of her nicknames included Violet and Sadie Sexy. Or Sexy Sadie.
Sexy Sadie, Sadie Sexy. Yeah, either way.
Right? She was notably... and it's said by a lot of the members and also Charlie himself that Susan was one of the most attractive women of the group, too. She did a lot for him. We'll talk about that. So she was another kid that came from California. and where she came from, San Jose. And she changed dramatically over time. So she did not have a great childhood. Her parents did not get along. It was not a great home life. And when she was very young, her mother passed away from cancer. She took care of her mom quite a bit. Like, she was the one in the house that really did the most care, and it really impacted her hard. After her mother passed, she kind of flipped a switch and just became somebody else. She rebelled quite a bit, and her dad couldn't handle it. After her dramatic change, she ended up dropping out of high school and running away from home. And this would lead her to becoming a dancer and hustler in San Francisco. And that's where she met Manson in 1967. She joined the family because she was one of the members that actually thought he was Jesus. And she was really in love with Charlie. And the reason why she went to the level that she did was she wanted to please him at all times. Kind of playing that role, right? Let's talk about Mary Brenner.
The big one.
The big one. The one that is oddly associated. Okay. So, some nicknames. Ach, Mother Mary, and Mariachi.
I mean, if you put Mother Mary and Ach together, that does make sense, but...
Right. I know, I'm like...
Maybe she liked to sing, and since he liked music, Mariachi, maybe she did a little dance. I don't know.
Maybe. Whatever. Right? I'm like, where are these coming from?
They were crazy, so who knows? Yeah. I don't know.
Right? But you are right. She did like music, so maybe that played, but...
Maybe she liked mariachi music.
Maybe.
I can get down with some tacos and margaritas to mariachi.
Yeah. Heck yeah. It's a fun time.
Yeah.
So, surprise. Mary is actually from a middle-class family from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Surprise. Shout out hometown. She was actually working as a librarian in California at the time when she met Manson. A very level-headed girl. By all accounts, she was a very good student, very kind, smart. I mean, to be a librarian, you have to be smart anyway, but like she had a lot of potential. He ended up, and this is how they met. She was walking her dog, and he was just walking on the same sidewalk, and he ended up sweet-talking her because they got into a little bit of a conversation. He played with the dog a little bit, and then he mentions, oh, I don't have a place to stay. I don't know what I'm going to do. I mean, 60s, especially in California,
I mean,
different time.
Yeah, I know, still. But I'm just like, could you imagine that today?
Yeah.
No.
Mm-mm. And Mary was a very nice girl, and so I think that Midwest mentality really
yes,
did
ma'am.
It in. Yeah. So, yeah, it didn't take long. But he did end up sweet-talking her. And he said, oh, it'd just be a couple nights. Well, no. So, a couple nights turned into, I don't know if it was the first night or the second night, but he was able to play on that charismatic charm. And they ended up in a relationship. So he ended up staying quite a while.
Damn.
Uh-huh.
Well, I mean, that's the easiest way to...
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, secure or lock that down.
Right.
He really knew how to work it.
Mm-hmm. Which I'm like, ooh, dude.
And then the next step is get her pregnant.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll get there. Because it did happen. But before we get there, he pulled some shit. So they were together, and she really thought that they were exclusive, and she had a thing for him.
Aww.
And one night when she got home from work, there were other women in the apartment.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah. And he's like,
could you imagine?
Yeah. And so she had a problem with that, rightfully so.
I bet she did. Yeah.
And so he was like, baby, like. Really, like, it's the sign of the times. This is free love.
Free love.
We don't belong
man.
To anybody. We belong to everybody.
We belong to each other. Yeah. It's more love.
Yeah. So he
more love.
Yeah. he finally convinced her that she was being silly. And so
she believed it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. And because she really liked him a lot, she played along with it until it didn't bother her anymore. But yeah.
Or she convinced herself it didn't bother her
exactly.
anymore. Yeah.
Exactly. And I think it truly just still did through the whole thing. But yeah, after that, there were more people that got involved. He was constantly bringing other people over. And this is how it really began. She was technically, she is still considered the first member of the cult because of how the timeline played out. She went along with it, and she basically, that's how she joined the family. And in 1968, she gave birth to Charles' son, Valentine Michael Manson. And his nickname was Pooh Bear.
Aw.
Yeah.
And this is the subject of our listener tale.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Wow. Crazy.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's talk about Leslie Van Houten. So her nicknames were Lulu, Susan, and Green. And I'm not even giving all the nicknames for all of them because they all have like eight. I'm just giving you the good ones, you know. Leslie came from Los Angeles. By all accounts that I found, her parents did everything they could for her. Everything. All around, good, happy family growing up. Everything was perfect until they divorced. So this really had an effect on Leslie during and after the divorce. She did not have a good time with that. It affected her immensely. And she then turned to sex and drugs. And this happened while she was in high school. So she tried to grow in college and become, you know, better. She was kind of realizing like, okay, yeah, I kind of had a weird moment there. Like maybe I really should try to be better. And for her, that looked like being a religious figure. So she kind of became this self-proclaimed nun in a way in college, but it kind of backfired. As you can imagine, joining now a cult, she decided that she wanted change. And so she kind of went back to the whole sex and drugs thing. And she was traveling all around California when she met Manson. So during this time, how that happened, while she was on her travels, she ended up actually running into Bobby Cupid Beausoleil. And they became lovers. And that's when he started talking about Manson with her. And she actually became very intrigued and fascinated by this person and wanted to meet him. And so he took her to meet him, and she was immediately a member. Very intrigued by him. And the other person we're going to talk about today is Charles Tex Watson. Nicknames.
Ooh.
Uh-huh.
Oh, Tex. Yeah. Tex.
You know this guy.
Mm-hmm.
Tex, Texas Charlie, or Mad Charlie.
Ooh, that's yeah. scary.
Mm-hmm. He's going to be the biggin in this group for a lot of things. Where did he get the name? Well, a boy's from Texas. And he was a great student while he was there. He was a proclaimed athlete. And he dropped out of college in 1966. His family would recall that the problems really started in college when he started taking drugs. And
I'll do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, when you're in college, you experiment. But back then it was kind of different. You know,
yeah, like
it
I mean, meant something else. Define drugs.
Yeah, exactly.
Define like,
what
drugs.
Which
rabbit hole are we going down here?
Yeah. You know. Yeah, exactly. It looked different back then than it does today. You
yeah.
know?
Yeah.
But still. A year after he dropped out of college, he was in California dealing drugs. That's how involved he did end up getting. Well, that's actually when and how he met Manson. More to come on Tex. We should also talk a little bit about David Lipsett. Some of his nicknames were Charlie. So a lot of them had the name Charlie, too, which I found interesting.
Yes, like, it's a really common name, I guess, right? For that time. You right. know how that is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But still. if everybody in your family member cult group is going to have the nickname Charlie.
It's going to get real. That's why you have to have the nicknames.
Yeah, right. He was also known as Karate Dave.
That is funny. Yeah. He's probably like, hoo ha ha. He's yeah. the one in the. He's just karate chopping everything.
Right. Well, what's weird is like, okay, having that nickname is kind of funny, but like he was a serious dude. So like that, like it's scary, but also it makes it kind of funnier. But
funny. Like, yeah.
So karate. Right. Karate Dave. If you don't watch it, you're going to deal with Karate Dave. So. He hailed from the Bay Area. He was actually a Vietnam veteran, and he was an expert in the martial arts, which is how he ended up getting the nickname Karate Dave. Mm. Some people's accounts of him say that he had numerous bullet wounds and just like battle scars all over his body.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And he was absolutely somebody that you did not want to mess around with. He was a very serious person. He had met Manson and only hung out for the drugs and the sex. So he wasn't like...
I'm not really into this cult thing, but I'm kind of on board with the drugs and the sex part.
Yeah. I'm here for the good times and not the weird times, you know? Like, yeah. And what's weird and like, kind of funny, but also like, was he actually taught some of the members karate?
I mean, yeah,
that's how he kind of gave back, in quotes. Like,
go see Karate Dave.
Yeah, you've leveled up, you can go to Karate Dave and learn karate. Yeah, but I don't think karate ever came into play with anything that ever went down, so. And we're also, okay, somebody else we have to talk about is Steve Clem Groggin. Some nicknames, Clem Tufts and Scramblehead. He's from LA. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. It'll come to play later. He was considered to not be a very bright person, and that will be debated later, too. He had dropped out of high school and was very involved with the Manson family. He was a young member. He was a problem child. His parents at one point actually got so frustrated with him after he dropped out, they gave up on him, and they dropped him off at the Spahn Ranch, which, if you know the name, you know about some of the stuff that went down there. That could be its own whole episode, honestly. So... we won't go into nitty-gritty details on Spahn Ranch, but he was dropped off at Spahn Ranch because his parents just could not handle him anymore. He was involved with a ranch way before Manson was, that should be noted. And while he worked there, there was a man named Donald Shorty Shea, who was a ranch hand and actually a stuntman. California, I tell you. Yeah. And Donald kind of took him under his wing, and he bought him clothes, he took care of him, he showed him the ways of the ranch so that he could stick around and be successful as a worker out there. Donald's gonna come back too in this story. Clem was also a musician who knew Dennis Wilson, and if that name rings a bell, Dennis Wilson was part of the Beach Boys.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which... that's how he kind of got involved with Manson, actually. We'll talk about Dennis later. Not so good vibrations in this point.
No.
He assisted with the murder of his mentor, Shay, the man who helped him get a foot up in life, because Manson suspected Shay of reporting some activity to the police because he was very paranoid and he straight up did not like Donald. And we'll get into that. But he ordered Groggin and others to take care of the job. But we'll get into that. We also have to talk about Linda Kasabian, I think. Her most prominent nickname was Yana the Witch. And she was actually from New Hampshire. Her family struggled financially and home life wasn't the greatest. Many said that she was a good student, but she was another one that dropped out of high school and ran away from home. She got married at the age of 16, divorced a short time later, went to Miami for a while, reconnected with her dad, which didn't work at all. So she moved up to Boston, married again, and then had a child at 1968. But that marriage would also end. So she ended up moving back with her mom, with her daughter for a little bit. Did not work out. Robert, her ex, wanted back and convinced her to do so. So that's when she had a second child. Long story short, Robert left again. And one of her friends told her all about this group of hippies on a ranch escaping society to create a new community. And Linda was intrigued and decided to follow her friend to Spawn Ranch, where she would meet Manson. She did everything that she could to make the family happy as well. Patricia Krenwinkle, known as Big Patty, Crazy Patty, and Yellow Marnie Reeves. Where are you getting these names from? She also was from LA, and she became addicted to dietary pills at a very young age. She suffered from a lot of body image issues growing up, which unfortunately is a very common thing for girls at a young age. From a very young age, she was full of loneliness. She didn't have a great home life, and she suffered from a lot of different things, and body image was a big one for her. So she really became addicted to dietary pills because she wanted to lose weight. She did, but she would still feel very ugly and unloved. So when Manson came around, she kind of latched on to him because he actually paid attention to her. She wasn't ignored like she had been by other people. And it didn't take long, like less than a day, for her to be hooked on Manson and join. He paid a lot of attention to her because he saw right through her and saw the vulnerabilities right away. And this came about because her sister Charlene was a heroin addict, and she would hang out with random people who had the goods. And this just automatically exposed Patricia to this kind of thing. So they both ran away with Manson. Actually, with Patricia, they hooked up same night. There's a lot of, okay, that should be noted. A lot of these interviews that I watch with these people, the 60s were a wild time, and nobody batted an eye during interviews. But they're like, yeah, I met Manson. At the time, he was really intriguing and, you know, really charismatic. And, you know, he gave me something to drink, and we had like a little bit of acid, but then we made love.
Mm-hmm.
And that, like, every interview, I'm like, okay.
It's just part of the man. The free love, just immediately. That's how you get to know a person.
Right? Yeah. Oh, but she's technically considered the third girl of the Manson group.
Okay.
But, and the last person that I'm going to bring up as an individual member, because she did some crazy shit, was Lynette Squeaky Fromm. Her nicknames were Red and Squeaky. I don't know if you want to know why her nickname was Squeaky.
I definitely want to know now that you said that.
So, and I think I might have written it in Macabre Morsels too, but one of the people on Spawn Ranch, his name was George. They kind of took advantage of George a little bit. George liked all of these young impressionable ladies coming around, right? That he felt, you know, very intrigued by. A lot of people were enchanted by the Manson family. I just want to say that right off the bat. So many people were intrigued and kind of wanted in because they were jealous of Manson with sex and drugs and all that stuff. George being one of them. And George had a thing for Lynette, and that's how she ended up getting the nickname Squeaky, because he would say that apparently when he would touch Lynette, she squeaked. It's gross. Yep.
Gross. Yeah.
It's gross. It's really gross. But she became friends with Manson in 1967 right away. Actually, she began traveling with him and Mary and Susan, and then Patricia being involved as well. She did not assist with the cult murders, but she did protest that Manson was innocent. Like, she was one of the main people that, like, slept outside of the courtroom and, like, was like, he's innocent, blah, blah, blah. and she refused to testify also. Also, she was the one that tried assassinating a president. So, oh yeah, we'll get into that later.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's why she got brought up, and I am listing her in the member group.
You earned a degree in the behavioral health field because you wanted to make a difference. And you're needed now more than ever. Through the new Great Minds Fellowship Program, recent Ohio graduates may be able to receive as much as $20,000 in student loan support when working full-time at a community behavioral health center. Apply before November 15th. To learn more about program eligibility, visit highered.ohio.gov. That's highered.ohio.gov.
So what happened? There's a lot that happened. The best way to do this is to go in chronological order. I'm not going to get into, they're not petty, but in this case, it's almost like the petty crimes or the side crimes that happened. We're just going to get into the big incidents. Because it's, they wreaked a lot of havoc. So we're going to start with July 25th of 1969. And this would be the Hinman murder. If that name sounds familiar, it's because I brought him up before. Hinman was actually somebody that knew Bobby Beausoleil. So the man that actually introduced Manson to Dennis Wilson, actually, from the Beach Boys, initially was Gary Hinman. So Gary Hinman was a music teacher and he mentored Bobby. And he lived with Gary for a while. That's how Bobby kind of became that connection. Well, Bobby ended up being the person that tortured and murdered Gary in his own home.
Mm.
Yeah. In Hinman's blood, he wrote the words political pig on the wall. Mm.
That's the one.
Yep. And this will become a trend, as we know. But that's kind of all I'm going to get into for the Hinman murders, because it's kind of straightforward. The big one that I know that everybody's itching to talk about is what happened on August 9th of 1969, which are the Tate murders.
Yeah.
And this one was a big one. This was the one that really shocked everybody, because this was the first time that you were seeing big name people in this way, you know. So what happened? Well, we got to talk about Sharon Tate. So she was an actress that was kind of mostly known for her role in Valley of the Dolls in 1967, and she was married to filmmaker Roman Polanski. And at the time of the murders, Sharon was 8 months pregnant. This is another trigger warning, because it's going to get brutal.
It's so sad. It's
very sad. And when you hear something I had included in the Macabre Morsels, it just like you want to slap somebody, but we'll get there. In the summer of 1969, the couple was renting a house on Celio Drive. This was in a neighborhood in Los Angeles. Now, this was something that in the beginning, people thought it was actually Polanski, because he was gone. He was in Europe when this happened. And because of how close Sharon was getting to the time, there were friends that were staying with her that could take care of her. Roman Polanski had nothing to do with this. And I mean, people know that now, but at the time he was kind of getting framed for some of this stuff. So his friend Wojciech Frykowski, I'm so sorry if I'm mispronouncing that, he was there along with his girlfriend, who was actually the heiress of Folger's Coffee, Abigail Folger. They were staying with Sharon. So there's going to be some weird theories later that we're going to talk about on why this one actually happened. There's multiple. But how it went down is Manson ordered his followers to go to Celio Drive at this particular address. And he made specific people of the family go. The prominent one being Charles Tex Watson. But there were other people involved, and we'll get there. There were several people from the cult there. And what was quoted from Manson on this during trial was, "I want you to make it as gruesome as you can," end quote. Because he wanted to prove a point. And he was a little miffed because of a situation that went down when recording his music, and we'll get there too. But Manson was familiar with the house already because of that. The previous tenant that lived there was music producer Terry Melcher, which was the person that did his recording that he flubbed. He thought, kind of a side tangent, Manson thought that he, because he knew the right people, he was kind of that eccentric person that people are intrigued by, that he was going to get a record deal like that. But when he delivered in the recording studio, that's how Hollywood works. And not everybody's going to get in. He got mad. And this is just kind of like a retaliation thing. But Watson drove to the estate. Who was involved? Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, and Linda Kasabian. Linda Kasabian, I believe, was the driver. When they arrived at the property, it was well after midnight, and they had an encounter that they weren't really anticipating, and that was somebody by the name of Stephen Parent. He was an 18-year-old that was actually visiting the caretaker of the home at the time. The fact that he was there was just mere coincidence, and it was kind of wrong place, wrong time for Stephen, unfortunately. Watson shot Parent. Atkins and Krenwinkel broke into the main house while he was taking care of Stephen. And Kasabian was the one that stayed back. She was supposed to be the one watching the gates. The people in the house, so you also had hairstylist Jay Sebring there as well, who was also a very close friend of Tate's and Polanski's.
Yeah, I think he was mentioned as being Sharon's best friend.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. And yeah, none of them. Yeah. We'll get there. It wasn't, nobody really made it out. So when this went down, they were all brought into the living room, and Tate and Sebring were linked by ropes that were tied around their neck across a beam in the living room. Sebring, because it wasn't really, which is really bad to say, it wasn't really working out how the cult wanted, because it was not going smoothly, they ended up shooting Sebring to make it go faster. Frykowski and Folger were actually able to run. They were able to make it out of the house, but they wouldn't make it past the yard. Both were chased down and stabbed to death by Krenwinkel and Watson, and excessively so. They fatally stabbed Sharon, because, again, they had shot Sebring, but it wasn't working out how they wanted to, so they ended up stabbing Sharon. There was another component to this that I'm saving for Macabre Morsels, because Atkins and Watson were involved with that stabbing, and it's debated who actually did the job. A lot of people say it was Susan, and Susan kind of did brag about it. And we'll talk about what she had said in court on top of all of that. Not great. So when they left, Atkins had used Tate's blood to write the word pig on the front door. And that would be what happened for the Tate murders. The next day, on August 10th, you had the second most famous murders that they committed, the LaBianca murders. This was something that Manson wanted to make a point of, because who were the LaBiancas? They were a very wealthy entrepreneurship of grocers. They were a big name in California. They made a lot of money. They're very well known. He was looking to get the most wealthy, most big name people that you can imagine, because he wanted the attention. So this time, Manson went into the house with them. He didn't for the Tate murders. He wasn't even in the fucking car. Manson was in the LaBianca house. He had taken Watson, Atkins, Krenwinkel, and Kasabian again, as well as Leslie this time, and Clem. So he wanted more people involved with this one. Why? I don't know. I couldn't find why. But Manson knew that they were a big name grocer. He had a plan. He wanted to start making it look like a pattern, which we were seeing patterns with the other ones too. But unfortunately, at the time that they entered the home, both Lena and Rosemary LaBianca were present. Manson, along with Adkins and Watson, helped with tying up the couple. After that, Manson gave them strict instructions on what to do and left. So he's not even going to be present for the stuff that he's trying to carry out. He's going to be involved at that point, and then he's going to just like do what you do kind of deal. Which, whatever. This whole explanation later about how he was innocent and how he didn't carry it out doesn't factor. Because technicalities. But they ended up stabbing them both to death and wrapping them up their heads in pillowcases and strangling them with cords. It was another grotesque murder. They did write in blood on the walls again. I believe with both. Leslie would take a hit on this one as being one of the main people, but she actually was one of the people that couldn't go through with it. She wasn't the one that technically killed them, but I can't remember if it was Watkins or Clem that went up to her and said, you have to get your hands dirty, otherwise you're going to get in trouble. So she ended up, she was the one that ended up stabbing Rosemary in the back and the butt like 16 times.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. But she couldn't even be in the room. She went in another room while it was taking place because she didn't really truly realize what was truly going down with the family until she was involved here. And I, as I had mentioned before, she would do anything to make the family happy. And Charles was testing her here. So, yeah, really brutal. And the last one that we're going to talk about briefly is, of course, the Shea murder that took place on August 25th of the same year. This is coming back to Donald Shorty Shea, who kind of took Clem under his wing. And so this kind of has a long rolling story behind the scenes while the rest of this is taking place. Manson never liked Donald for multiple reasons, one of which was because he was married to a black woman and Charles was not having that. He was not a fan of that, and that immediately put him on the target list for Manson and other things that Donald did, because he was a straightforward man. And he was an honest man that if he saw something, he would say something. And that's why, as I kind of mentioned before, Manson was just suspicious of him because he really did believe that he was reporting what he was seeing to the cops on Spahn Ranch. So it kind of got to a boiling point for Manson, and he decided that he was going to just say, we're done with him, get rid of him. And he made Clem be involved with it. Clem was actually the one that carried through with it, which is really, it's sad because of what he had done for Clem. But yeah, that was a statement that was made, was they believed that Manson's followers had killed him on the orders of Manson because they feared that there was actually police informing involved and his body would go missing for 8 years. Once Clem was convicted, he did write up some maps and he did assist with helping the police find Donald's body at that time, but not before then. And it did grant him a few things with prison sentencing and whatnot. Now, this was just four of the main things that they did. Obviously, they did a fuck ton more. But this is really a heavy topic. Honestly, Manson could be his own podcast. You could talk about every individual on their own episode. And we don't have the time for that. But I did want to, now that we covered what they did, I wanted to let you know where they're at now, because it's been a while. And I think you're going to find some of this interesting. So Bobby Beausoleil. He is currently serving a life sentence in a medical facility in California for murdering Gary Hinman. He was denied parole in July of 2020. He will again be eligible this coming January. In 2019, the California Parole Board recommended him for release. And
really?
Yeah. Oh, you're going to see this for a few of them. I'm like, what are you doing, parole board? But Governor Gavin Newsom actually overturned it. And he overturned a bunch of these people. It didn't work for everybody, but good for you, Governor. But yeah, because it's like, you think that some of them, they were so young and have they learned, but also for what they did. Susan Atkins, she actually died on September 24th of 2009 at the California Women's Facility from brain cancer. So that's, she had done a couple interviews with people, but that was basically what happened to her. Mary Brunner, she was granted parole in 1977. Of course, there's the whole story about how she was involved with the group that tried hijacking the plane and everything. We did not get to that today. I thought giving details on that due to the sensibility and sensitivity of our anonymous listener tale, I wanted to kind of leave it a little bit. But she did disappear from the public eye after she was paroled in 77.
As you do.
Yep.
Yep.
And as for Valentine, you know, her parents fought hardcore for custody of him because he was kind of present. I mean, he was on the ranch kind of being passed from member to member for a little mm-hmm. bit as a very young child. And they wanted custody of him and they did win. So he went to go live with his grandparents.
Man, he needs to write a book.
Yeah. And then we have Leslie Van Hutten. On July 23rd of 2020, the California Parole Board recommended her for the fourth time to be paroled. It was denied in late November of the same year by Governor Newsom. Her attorney appealed the decision, though, and she was granted parole in July 11th of 2023.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And she allegedly made a small fortune off of the media coverage and interviews and a book deal that she did.
Not be allowed. That should not be allowed.
Mm-hmm. So she's currently living somewhere.
Yeah. Yep. I think there should be rules against that. I think any money should be to the victim's family, distant family.
Agreed.
That is just my personal opinion.
Yeah. I totally agree with you. And if no one is left in that line, I think it should be going back to doing stuff like the Jane Doe Project and stuff like that.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Some sort of victim rights or something. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, I totally agree. Yeah. Let's talk about Charles Tex Watson. He has been denied parole 18 times. He takes full responsibility for some of the murders, but when it comes to his parole hearings, suddenly he blames Manson for everything. Yeah. His next parole hearing is scheduled for October of 2026. His last denial was in October of 2021. We'll see. I don't think he'll be getting out, but David Lipsett, Karate Dave, after stealing a vehicle and other petty crimes, he was tried, and he actually escaped out of the jail window and was never seen again.
Are you serious? Okay.
Way to go, Karate Dave! That's why I mentioned him. He's just got, like, this wild story.
Karate Dave karate is out Dave. In the wild.
He is out there.
Teaching karate to somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. Yeah. That's where I tried to put some of the humor today, because David Lipsett, he kind of delivered a tiny bit of humor today.
Karate Dave, who knows, karate he could Dave. Be in a dojo somewhere.
Right?
Teaching karate.
Yeah. One of those people that, you know, you get to know later and just kind of like in a random conversation, he's like, Yeah, I used to hang out with Manson.
You know, just like,
yeah. What? Yeah. Some listener might be like, you know what? I'm pretty sure my karate teacher might be Karate Dave.
Have you ever heard of Karate Dave? And then he just like, you know, whips around. He's like, who said that? That is not my name.
Yeah. Just, yeah. Something like that. I just, oh my gosh. Can you imagine? So going to Steve Clem Grogan. So originally he was sentenced to death, which many of them were.
Wow.
Yeah. But due to laws changing in California in the 70s with the death penalty, all of the sentences that were delivered for death were then life imprisonment sentences. So he was one of them that received death sentenced, but then life in jail. But when the judge basically stated that he was too dumb and hopped up on drugs to really do something like that, his sentence was reduced. A lot of people will say that he just played dumb and that he truly was a little more with it than people thought he was. That's to be debated, but he was kind of known as the ditzy one of the group. So whether that was because of his drug use or not, that, who knows? After serving 15 years, he did get a little bit more shed off of his sentence. He did assist the authorities with finding the body of Donald Shay. And he had so much taken off of his sentence that he was released on November 11th of 1985.
Damn.
Yeah. Today, he is a musician living in Northern California where he plays with a few bands. Linda Kasabian, she turned herself into the police. She was a very young member of the group. The only reason why she ended up being involved with some of these big murders is because she was the one that had a valid driver's license. Yeah, she had turned herself in the later part of 1969. So she did it very quickly. She was granted immunity due to her role as a lead witness during the Manson trials, and she was the one that gave the most evidence and the most truth because a lot of them lied on the stand, and she got a lot of flack for that from the rest of the members, which we'll talk about. She died in Tacoma, Washington in January of 2023 at the age of 73. Patricia Krenwinkel, she was granted parole in May of 2022. But the decision was overruled by Governor Newsom once again, making it so she wasn't eligible again until June of 2024. And by all accounts, she is still incarcerated. Lynette Squeaky Fromm was granted parole in August of 2009 and moved to New York. According to records, as of January 2019, she lived with an ex-convict boyfriend who is obsessed with Manson, and lives in a house decorated with skulls. Neighbors say,
okay,
yeah. So I'm like, I don't know if she learned, but neighbor has quotedly said, quote, she's very friendly, end quote.
Okay.
And what happened to Manson? So Charles Manson died of natural causes in prison on November 19th of 2017 at the age of 83.
Seems like an easy way out.
Yep. He had been denied parole many times and claimed until the end that he was innocent.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. There's a lot of quotes from him that I'm not going to read because it just made me mad.
And also, fuck that guy.
Uh-huh. Exactly. He had been in prison this last stint for over 46 years, which means in total, he spent a very huge part of his life behind bars.
But also, he liked it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
We know that he liked it. Yeah. So
he did everything that he could to get back to jail. And honestly, when they first gave the death sentence to all of them for what they did, there were actually accounts from people saying that Manson was shaking and like cowering with a death sentence. And it's like, if you wanted so bad to be in jail, well, but then of course, like he kind of got his way. Because when the death penalty was overruled due to the
changes in California. He basically got his way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He got off way too easy, in my opinion. But, oh, you
definitely.
Know.
Yeah. And talking about that stuff, so Macabre Morsels, ooh, there were tapes of Tex Watson actually dating back prior to this stuff, where he's talking to his attorney about the murders. The LAPD still hasn't released it to the public. They discovered these tapes in 2008.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some interesting things there. As we had talked about Lynette Squeaky Fromm before, she tried assassinating President Gerald Ford due to protests for the Redwoods. And she did hold a gun up to him, and the gun didn't fire. Yeah. At one point, Manson was very good friends with Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys, which is how a lot of this shit took place.
And right.
Yeah. I mean, if Dennis would not have been involved, I don't know what this would have looked like. Mm-hmm. Not to say we're not blaming Dennis by any means, but like, it's just wild to know all of these big names that were being associated with this stuff, how that started. So
yeah.
Yeah. Really weird. And again, very 60s mentality. Dennis was driving along the road. He saw a group of young girls on the side of the road that wanted to hitchhike. So he picked them up. And he started joking around with them and stuff. They always said that he was a really nice guy. And he had said, hey, I'll take you back to my house for milk and cookies. Which, good old Dennis.
Okay.
The girls thought that he meant something else when he said, I'll take you back to my house for milk and cookies. They thought, oh yeah, wink, wink. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But literally, that's what he meant. He literally.
That's very Beach Boys.
It is very Beach Boys.
Yeah.
He took them back to their house, his house. And he's like, yeah, he set up milk and cookies. He's like, girls, have fun. I gotta go, but, you know, take your time, leave when you want. 60s, man. Yeah. But back when he would come back later and see all the lights on in his house and cars parked out front and see a bunch of people through the windows of his home, and he's like, what?
Just hanging out.
Yeah. And he's like, what in the hell is happening here? Well, here comes Manson walking out of the house like he fucking owned the place.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Came up to Dennis. He's like, how's it going? Dennis literally got scared, and he actually asked, are you going to hurt me? And Charles laughed, and he's like, no, why would I do that, man? Like, it's so good to meet you, and blah, blah, blah. And then they became friends. Yeah, and that's how the whole thing with Charlie recording his music in the studio, because Dennis actually was very intrigued by Manson's songs, and that's kind of how things got down, you know?
Yeah.
He took that rejection in the studio really hard, and it just escalated. No fault of Dennis, of course, but that's kind of how it all started.
Everybody has a trigger, man.
Yep.
And Charlie had an ego.
Oh, yeah.
And he thought so highly of himself and thought he was going to be this superstar and that he was the greatest.
Yeah, exactly. And a very chilling excerpt from a biography said that, quote, it was through this association with Manson that we're going to name drop here, because I did not know this and it is really scary, who wanted to be a musician, got the opportunity to audition for Terry Melcher, as we had talked about before, the son of Doris Day, who was a friend and producer of the popular 1960s band The Beach Boys. His association with Dennis and them. At the time, Melcher was a living household member with Roman Polanski, as we mentioned. And this is how ultimately Manson knew where to go, what to do. There is a name drop that I'm going to mention. Susan kind of spilled the beans about the Tate murders and what actually the intention was with it. There was supposed to be more celebrities that got offed. She went on to mention that they wanted to carry out more high-profile murders in Hollywood with people such as Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton, Steve McQueen, Frank Sinatra, and Tom Jones.
Damn.
Oh, yeah. And that was just to name a few on the list. Another thing that she decided she wanted to spill the beans on was, okay, they had a lot of murders. They were kind of accrued to like 35 in total. They can't prove all of them. And after the main four that we talked about, they didn't even really go to trial for the other ones. So that should be noted. But because of that, Susan kind of got cocky and started just talking about things. And talking about the Sharon Tate murders, she admitted that she wanted to cut out Sharon's baby during that time, but she didn't have the time. It's like, really? I just want to to the face. But yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So that just like pissed me off when I heard that. Something else to, you know, Beach Boys, big name. So I kind of wanted to give you this if you didn't know this. Manson allegedly did record music at Dennis's home with his brother Brian Wilson. Additionally, the Beach Boys did release a song that was written by Manson, which I did not know that. I thought they kind of left that in the back burner, you know? Manson's song that he called Cease to Exist was actually renamed by the Beach Boys, and it's the song Never Learn Not to Love that was featured on their 1969 album 2020 as a B-side.
Really?
Yeah, I did not know that. So I wanted to throw that little nugget in there. And then we should mention somebody else, because even though they were on trial, the murders did not stop. Something that probably people are already thinking about, like, why didn't you mention this? I am mentioning it now. Lawyer Ronald Hughes, who was named as attorney for Manson and Van Houten. Well, it got weird because Hughes ended up dropping Manson as a client, reportedly because he felt that he could convince the jury that Van Houten was just unashamedly influenced by the cult leader. So he was like, all right, I'm kind of stepping back on this one. And the move, we believe, cost him his life, because late in the year that this happened, Hughes went camping and disappeared. And his decomposed body turned up several months later, and it was thought that he was a victim of the retaliation of the family cult. I do think that that is the case, but Manson and the convicted family would often start laughing in the courtroom, making faces at each other, and reports said that they showed no remorse during trial, which is another, like, I just want to slap you in the face.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is also another tragic fact. The son that Charles had with his first wife, Rosalie, ended up committing suicide in the 1990s. I don't know if it was because of his association, like who his dad was. I'm not sure, but it's just more tragedy to add on top of everything else. And the last macabre morsel that I have for you today, which is equally as sickening. Manson had a girlfriend in the 20-teens in jail because he's not done, apparently. He just kept going. They did actually obtain a marriage license, but it was legally, it fell through. And then a few years after, he ended up passing away. But the girl who called herself Star and Manson started their relationship when she was 19 years old. And by the time they obtained the marriage license, she was 26 and he was 80. Yeah. And apparently she's always had a thing for him and like started. Yeah. A lot of people think that she had done this to just gain financial gain from this, obviously, but either way, gross.
Yeah, gross.
Mm-hmm. Whoa. That's what I've got for you. Really long episode. My apologies if y'all tushies are sore, but oh my gosh, we could not cover this because of that. Thank you, anonymous listener, for submitting your story. This was freaking huge. So thank you so much. And guess what? You could potentially be featured on an Alphabet episode as well if you submit your stories to us, because we do actually like hearing from you, believe it or not. and we would love to. And those stories could be anything from paranormal, true crime, personal creepy stories, hometown macabre. Macabre is a very large umbrella, so it's all welcome. You may just be featured in a hometown macabre, and you may just be featured in an Alphabet episode, so please submit those. You can do so by writing to us at thatsomacabre@gmail.com. You can record your story on macabrepod.com on our SpeakPipe option. If you want a little bit more from us, we are on Patreon. We have a private Facebook group with some amazing people over there. Big shout out to the Macabre fam over there. Our family is not like the Manson family, I just want to say.
No, definitely not.
One, we're cooler. And two,
It's definitely not murdery, yeah, over there.
Exactly.
We do not condone murder.
No. No. But we have a great time. Also, keep posting pictures of your pets for our edition with the Critter Choir, because they're always great to see. And if you like what you're hearing, we would really appreciate a rating and review on your favorite podcast platform, because we'd like to hear from you in all kinds of ways. Over here at Macabre, we believe in the buddy system. So tell a buddy, buddy, because it's just kind of fun to talk with your friends about some of the wild shit we talk about over here, because that's why we started the show. Buddy telling buddy a story. And it's fun to do. But as always, my friends, have fun. Be safe. Be kind, and you know what? Negative energy, let's not out there. Let's just not. It's not allowed. We love you, and I guess we'll shock you later.
Till next time.
Bye.